Welcome to Lectionary Lunch. We are liturgical, iconodules, holding to the tradition of Palm Sunday, rather than pretending it's the Sunday of the Passion. So all you people out there, please go to church during Lent, and especially on Good Friday. John 12, the Johannine Palm Sunday account, is the gospel lesson. And let's just read through it and make a few comments. What's really nice about the Palm Sunday accounts is that each one of them really, I mean, they're obviously all the same event, but they each have their own emphases. And so John 12, beginning at verse 12. So we have te epauran. Epauran is actually an adverb, but with the article it means the next day. So it's the dative of time when, simply on the next day. Then we have the big crowd. Now we modify crowd by repeating the article and putting a participle after it. So we have a participle in attributive position, and it modifies crowd. So which crowd? The big crowd which was coming into the feast. So it's the feast of Passover. There goes the fire alarm. And we'll hope that doesn't go off again. So the great crowd, which was coming into the feast, Jerusalem, the estimates are probably, hard to make, but I've read at least that during the great feast, Jerusalem's population would swell to, 60, 80,000 people, where normally it might be, say, 20,000. So there's a lot of people in the city. Akousantes, when they had heard, this participle in predicate position, so we'll take it either temporarily or perhaps causally, because they had heard that Jesus literally is coming into Jerusalem. Now, hold on to your hats. Let's do the relative time thing. The main verb of this sentence is the first word in verse 13, elabon. They took. Past time, the participle akousantes is dependent upon that for its relative time, and so that's why we would translate the participle akousantes when they had heard, or because they had heard. And now the huti clause, which is reporting indirect discourse, the participle has a relative time of past, so we translated that Jesus was coming. Okay. That's not very preachable.
That would be a good test question.
Yeah, it would be a good test question, so we'll just keep going on. When they had heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, they took... This is a little repetitious. I had to look it up, actually. When I saw phoenikon, I thought it was the word phoenix. And as a matter of fact, it is the word phoenix. It's like the lexicon gives two definitions for the same spelling. This word means palm tree. And a bion is a palm branch. So it's actually a little repetitive. They took the palm branches of the palm trees, and ex aelthon, they went out from ex erkomai, just an aorist indicative, active, third singular, or third plural. They went out unto a meeting to him. The dative pronoun looked a little odd to me there, but the lexicon said that this is just one of the ways to pattern things after the noun hip aintesis, meeting. In order to meet him, you could say it that way. And now we have an imperfect ekraugadzon. This is from kraugadzo. You see the temporal augment on the front, and the zeta shows you it's still the present stem. And so they began to cry, maybe, or they kept on crying, or something like that, not just cried out. It lends a little air of vividness and excitement to which is obviously a chaotic scene. And now we have a partial quote from Psalm 118. And the people say, Hosanna, which is, as you know, roughly translated, save now, or save, please. Hosanna, eola ge menas ha erkamenas en anamati kiri'u. The one who is coming in the name of the Lord, and now eola ge menas counts just as an adjective here, is blessed. And who is this one? The King of Israel. So they acknowledge Jesus in some sense to be coming in the Lord's name and to be Israel's true king. Jesus found a donkey. We have a couple of different words for donkey and colt and things like this. I think that's probably just an example of the way that St. John loves to slightly shift his vocabulary without any particular different nuance and meaning. I mean, the most boring article in the history of scholarship is written by Leon Morris in a book, Studies in the Fourth Gospel, and the title is something like Stylistic Variation, a Feature of Johannine Style, followed by like 9,000 examples of how John just shifts words around a little bit. It doesn't seem to make any difference. So here we've got an onarion. Jesus, finding a donkey, Jesus sat on it, just as it has been and is written. And now we have kind of a quote from Zechariah 9:9. I say kind of a quote because Zechariah begins with, "Rejoice, daughter of Zion." None of the synoptics actually do it that way, and John doesn't either. It's probably to highlight the tension between what the daughter of Zion is expecting and what the daughter of Zion will actually get. Okay? So Matthew does the same thing in a slightly different way. So how the quote starts is, "Me fabu, don't be afraid, daughter Zion," or perhaps daughter of Zion. "Look, you were right, although you don't know it. Your king is coming to you as he sits upon the colt of a donkey." So an easy enough quote. Now, in a sense, you can't overplay that Jesus is gentle, humble, and mild because he's riding on a donkey, not a war horse, because the donkey is actually a royal steed. Wasn't it at the rebellion of Adonijah? And remember when Bathsheba, I know this because I listened to a Bible record when I was a kid.
This is good.
So what happened was that Solomon got David's donkey, right? And he rode down to the brook and was anointed, you know, king by Abiathar? Nathan was the prophet. Who was the priest? Was it Abiathar?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I have this Bible record in my head. Abiathar the priest. Like that. It works. So anyway, the king is coming, but in the rest of the reading, we actually get the stark contrast when you, and John makes sure that we won't miss it. I mean, on this point, at least, the synoptists are a little more subtle, but John just lays it out for us here. And it's the contrast between worldly glory and divine glory. You know? And so it is, in a sense, the same old theology of Palm Sunday. But I think the preacher really has an opportunity here to try to think about, you know, his own life, the life of his people, and how universally we are tempted to want a certain kind of glory in our experience as Christians. And how the pattern established by the Lord Jesus is the pattern of cross-like glory first, only then, you know, resurrection. So it's really, I think, it's hard to preach. After you've preached Palm Sunday about 5 times, you feel like you're running out of something to say. But I think the opportunity is maybe just to think more deeply about life and about Christians' experience and how hard life can actually be, unless you're willing to live it superficially. And I think if you happen to be a North American who has a lot of money and health insurance, then you can choose to live life superficially. But if you actually try to live life profoundly, then you will experience the need for the hope that comes from this kind of a text. So anyway, let's get to the goods. Verse 16. These things his disciples did not know. Autu looks odd. It precedes the noun. It modifies rather than follows it. But you can see, as Dr. Bartelt likes to say, there's a flag on the play. And a variant reading changes the order. These things his disciples did not know, ta proton, in the first place, or at first. But, Allah, when Jesus was glorified. Now, does this refer to the cross or to Easter? And I think the answer might be both. Because they didn't actually get it, you know, until after the deed is completely done. But in the first place, as you know, the Son of Man being lifted up, glorified. Here in chapter 12, actually, Jesus specifically talks about this. But when Jesus was glorified, then amnestezon. This is from mnemoskomai, means to remember. And it's a deponent, so it's aorist passive indicative in form, but active in meaning. They remembered that these things, and then you've got ein ep auto gegramena. Ein is the imperfect of eimi, and it goes with the participle. So it's a what's called a periphrastic construction. These things were and had been and were still written, something like that, about him, ep auto. And tauta epoiesan auto. They did these things to him. Now what does that mean? What are they doing? Well, they're hailing him. They're celebrating him. They're rejoicing in him, see? But they have no idea, they have absolutely no idea of what they're actually doing. Which kind of makes it unnecessary, the conversation that you hear about, oh, those fickle crowds, how could they like Jesus so much on Palm Sunday and then later crucify him? Now, you can solve the problem by saying, well, it's not the same people, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think you should give the crowds on Palm Sunday too much credit. They don't actually know what's going on. See, they're not hailing the real Jesus. They just think they are. And so the question might be, this would be actually a good sermon theme. I feel like Reed Lessing all of a sudden. Do you want the real Jesus? You could preach that, right? The Jesus who has to suffer and die and rise. Now this is an interesting detail that John gives us in verse 17. Therefore the crowd, now we modify crowd, ha'on metato, the one with him, when the Lazarus he called from the tomb and raised him from the dead, that's all part of the subject in a sense. That crowd, emartire, this is from martireo. And you, the temporal augment, you know, lets you know that it's actually a past time indicative. This is because of the epsilon contract verb. It looks funny. It's actually an imperfect indicative active. Imperfect. Third person singular. Kept on bearing witness. And they're saying, hey, he raised this guy from the dead. If you can't have more glory and success than that, there's something wrong with you. Right? Okay. But what they don't realize is that Jesus himself is going to die. Right? That's what they don't get. Therefore, verse 18, Diatuta, on account of this also, the crowd greeted him. Only John tells us that, you know, the recent miracle, of course, only John has the miracle of the raising of Lazarus, but this is what's part of the hubbub on Palm Sunday, is the rumor, the report had gone out that Jesus had actually raised Lazarus from the dead. Right? That would bring a crowd, wouldn't it? You know, if that was in the Post-Dispatch on a Saturday and on Sunday morning, you know, Pastor Ben Smith at Wrath of God Lutheran Church raised somebody from the dead yesterday, they'd probably come to church the next day.
They'd be disappointed.
They would be, that's right. Well, not if you preach Jesus. Well, they might still be disappointed, actually. So. Therefore, the crowd went out to greet him because they had heard. And now here's the infinitive is expressing indirect discourse. They had heard, auton is the subject, him to have done, pepoi ekenai. Just when you thought that John's Greek was simple, he gives you a perfect infinitive of indirect discourse. See? And why am I the only one who seems to be rejoicing about that? So, no, everyone else is rejoicing. So they heard him, is the subject of the infinitive, him to have done, tuta has to go with te simeon. This sign, right? But of course, part of the message of John is Jesus does the signs, but nobody understands that to which the signs are pointing, right? Verse 19, now we get irony. Irony happens not least when someone says something and they're speaking the truth, but they don't understand it. Therefore, the Pharisees said to themselves, hey, autus, Theoreta, you see, or see that you, plural, are helping in no way, uden. Ida, look. This is actually an imperative. It's singular, but it's kind of a little idiom. It's like a particle. It's not really kind of a real verb form. It's just looky here, almost like idu. Look, the world has gone out after him. By the way, the next text is when Greeks come to Jesus and they say, or to Philip, and they say, we want to see Jesus. And Jesus says, now the hour has come. Right? I like to make Dr. Shuckard mad by calling John the nudge, nudge, wink, wink gospel. Because he just kind of lays it out there for you sometimes. It's a little obvious. Right? So the Pharisees think that the whole world has gone out after Jesus in the sense of they like the way he is and he's going to be popular and he's going to be successful. Jesus knows, and I, when I am lifted up, I will draw all people to myself. Right? So, again, it's the same Palm Sunday teaching that you get in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where the crowds are unaware; they're thinking of, you know, regular glory, earthly glory. Here in John, it's even augmented. They're thinking of no more death. He raises people from the dead. How could you hope for a better king than that, right? When, in fact, it's a little obvious, but it's the gospel. This king has come first to die, first to be lifted up and to be glorified in that sense. So, again, it's because it's kind of an obvious theology in this text, and because, you know, faithful Christians will have heard it many times, right? I think the challenge for the preacher, you know, might be something like this: to really try to discern some of the more subtle ways, you know, even for pious Christians, faithful church-going Christians, the subtle ways that, you know, a theology of glory really affects the way we approach God, the way we approach life, and things like that. So in this case, maybe, again, given that it's Palm Sunday, given that it's familiar, the exegesis of life, you know, of the life of the preacher himself, the life of the congregation, the life of our culture, see, that exegesis might be the more challenging, well, I think it probably would be the more challenging, than the exegesis of the text. Because, again, John just kind of lays it out there. Nobody got it until after he had been glorified. So, but it's a, in that sense, to be a preacher is a good opportunity to be a Christian, because you get to ponder these things and, you know, apply them to your own life first, and then to the life of a congregation. So, any questions? We got a few minutes. Dr. Bartel didn't take as long. Things about the text? I didn't really dwell on it. This palm branch thing is probably has a strong nationalistic feel to it. There are coins from the Hasmonean period that show palm branches on them. And so this is a standard observation. I think it's probably right that...
And that it wasn't the sign of a ruler, a reed or something?
Well, yeah. Again, so they're thinking king, right? Yeah. Now, again, don't make the mistake of... we shouldn't make the mistake of separating church and state. For them, for Jesus to be the earthly king was the same thing as the spiritual king. Okay? You know, they're not thinking just political. They're thinking a righteous king, right? Someone like David, who for all of his faults and sins never led the people into idolatry. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. This is what separates a good king from a bad king, right? It's not that he doesn't sin. It's that he does not lead the nation into idolatry. So in that sense, I've often wondered if that's the sense in which David is actually a man after God's own heart, as he's called, I think, at least twice in the historical books, former prophets, because, I mean, he's a sinner like the rest of us. But it's Solomon that begins the idolatry, right, when he has all these foreign wives and alliances and so forth. And so they're thinking, when they think, blessed is the one who comes from the Lord, the King of Israel, and they wave the palm branches, they're not separating in their own minds politics and theology, right? They're kind of merging it all together. So, good. Anything else? All right, very good. Well, thank you very much. And next week will be Easter. So, now let's just go ahead and say, He's risen indeed.